Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for this morning is United States against Manojlovic. Mr. Greenberg.
Morning, Your Honors. This case involves a sentencing enhancement from which the judge then imposed a guideline sentence at the low end of the guidelines, including the enhancement. It was an obstruction enhancement. Factually, what happened was that my client, Manojlovic, I believe, but I can call him Rade. The Rade went into his to do the pre-sentence investigation, and like all defendants, he was given a stack of forms to fill out, sat at a table at the office, and filled out those forms, and did not include, when he filled out the forms, several bank accounts. One of those bank accounts, he later that same day made a deposit to. The government learned about it, or the pre-sentence investigator learned about it, asked about it. He went back in. He said
several months later, though, right?
Well, when they learned about it fairly quickly, and then there was, they called me, I called him, we went back in. It wasn't a situation where the time was really significant, and here's why. Because on that date, the money came into the account, and it went out of the account, and it was used for legitimate expenses.
That doesn't excuse non-disclosure, though. I mean, I don't know why he didn't just amend his disclosure the next day, for example.
Well, I don't know that he's told to do that. You have to people go in to do the pre-sentence investigation, and they're typically very nervous. They're given a lot of forms. They're upset. They're looking at going to jail. This is a man who went to trial, who did not believe, although I have to say that the facts were stacked against him. I didn't represent him at trial. Didn't believe that he did anything wrong and was very upset throughout the entire process and very emotional through the entire process. The question isn't just whether, however, he failed to disclose something. It's what effect did it have? And here, it has no effect. So when the term materiality is disposed of is if it's meaningless in cases like this, and it shouldn't be. No one has said that this money would have been available for restitution. No one has said.
$25,000, right?
It was $25,000.
Yeah, it's not an insignificant amount to most people.
It is not an insignificant amount, but importantly, the government never claimed that that money was not used for legitimate personal expenses. The government never claimed that that money was not used for legal expenses to hire a new lawyer, which happened to be me. So there's no whether they've known about
the question is whether it's material, though, and under the guidelines commentary, to be material, it need only tend to influence. There's no actual influence requirement.
No, but to tend to influence, what does that really mean? So let me give you this scenario. When he's in the morning, had he reported that account, it had zero balance. The next day, as Your Honor said, had he reported that account, it had zero balance.
But suppose it had been $1 million. I mean, a rule that says as long as you manage to spend all the money within a day, it's not material seems to me not a tenable rule. It doesn't say, that's not what the guidelines say. And if it had been $1 million and he'd spent his way through it, the district court well may have thought you shouldn't have spent all that money. He still would have zeroed it out, just as you've described.
Right, but the district court didn't find that, and it wasn't $1 million, and that's a much different scenario.
Well, but I'm trying to nail down the rule you're talking about, and the rule is you tell the district court and let the district court then make the decision that, as perhaps is the case here, he used it for legitimate purposes and it wouldn't have changed things. But one doesn't make these decisions behind a curtain.
No, but when it came out, there's nothing to indicate that it would have influenced the court's decision, that it would have tended to influence the court's decision. Because
those are the same thing, actual influence and tend to influence?
Right. But because the money was used for legitimate purposes and it wasn't this great amount of money, it didn't affect anything. So it's sort of a no harm, no foul rule is really what it should be. When we're talking about enhancing someone's sentence, I would also point out that the court also should have made some kind of finding that it was under the second prong, that it was related to the offense of conviction or relevant conduct, and it wasn't. It had nothing to do with it.
Well, it's not just this $25,000, like three or four bank accounts, right?
That all had no money in them.
Well, but they exist. I mean, again, the system doesn't work if people don't disclose properly.
I agree. The system doesn't work if people don't disclose properly. But when we're penalizing someone for not disclosing properly, we have to look at what was the effect of that non-disclosure. And that's why it has the requirement of tend to influence or actually influence. And in this case, none of it meant anything. They were bank accounts. There was a lot of information he did provide, first of all. So you can't say that he was trying to hide things because he provided a lot of information. He didn't go in and say, I don't know anything about anything. He went in and gave them stacks of information and disclosed many bank accounts to the probation officer. And then there were other things. And when the probation officer called him in the second time and he went in there, he was honest, open, provided whatever records they asked for and so forth. So you can't just from that say, well, because on the first day you didn't write everything down, which is what they're saying here. Because on the first day you were in, you didn't write everything down. Then you must have tended to obstruct or wanted to obstruct. Importantly, he doesn't get a copy of what he fills out for probation. You don't get a copy of this and get told, go home, double check it against your records. Like someone, if they get a request to produce, they take it home, they look at it, they make sure they've got all their records, it's prepared, they compare it against the record. That's not what happens here. You get called in, you get this form that's pages and pages and pages and pages, and you get told, fill it out, and then you give it to them.
What was the value of everything disclosed, whatever that...
He didn't have anything of any consequence at all. He had basically no assets. And in fact, the court found its sentencing that he didn't have the ability to pay a fine, he didn't have the ability to pay the cost of incarceration, he didn't have the ability to pay the cost of supervision, that he was essentially indigent. The court found that. The court did not say, look, you've hid assets, you've wasted away assets or anything like that, which I think would be important if you're going to make a decision that affects the sentence. If you're going to enhance the sentence because you felt that he tried to obstruct and that tends to influence your decision, then you should be making some finding that if you hadn't done this, there would be money available or something like that.
But that's the rule, though.
You're conflating actual materiality with the actual definition of materiality in the guidelines, and those are two different things. This isn't like a civil fraud case where you have to show actual materiality. This is a guidelines dispute, and so all it needs to do is, on an objective basis, have a tendency to affect the issue at hand, which is what his assets actually are for purposes of the sentencing decision. It's a very low standard of materiality.
And I guess our position is that it shouldn't be quite so low. It shouldn't be quite so disposable, because when you're talking about it and you're saying it tended to influence the issue, what issue did it tend to influence? He had nothing. He didn't disclose nothing.
Disclosure of assets and full and complete and honest disclosure of assets always has a tendency to influence sentencing decisions to the extent that fines and restitution are on the table, which they always are.
Right, but he didn't have anything in these accounts. Had he disclosed them, it wouldn't have had any effect. In the morning when he was there, they would have said zero.
Ultimately, that was true. But at the time he made the disclosure, he knew that this $25,000 was coming in, and he didn't report it.
There's frankly, he may have known.
And he didn't fess up to it until he was called on it.
He did not fess up on it until they asked him about it. That is true. Thank you.
Can I have a little time for rebuttal, if you like. Mr. Havey.
May it please the court, counsel, what we have here is a case that I would argue is not just about simple non-disclosure. It's an affirmative lie. The defendant lied to the probation officer about his income. The probation officer looked at what was presented to him, and he said, this is an obstruction. The district court looked at it and without hesitation said, this is an obstruction. I would submit, Your Honors, that this is not a particularly close call. And as you pointed out, Judge, the system doesn't work if we don't have complete honesty here. That's the whole point of this guideline, is to maintain the integrity of the judicial process here. A lie to the probation officer is a lie to the court. And what did he lie about? Here. He lied about his income. $25,000. He failed to disclose four bank accounts. He failed to disclose that he was an officer in a corporation that we know nothing about. And let's talk about the timing of these disclosures. Mr. Greenberg said he filed the thing first, filed the statement first thing and then later made a deposit. We don't know the timing of this. We just know it happened on the same day. The government didn't find out about it right away. We didn't find out about it until the FBI received a CTR from the bank.
I thought I remembered it was about 2 months. Is that, where am I
going? We informed the probation officer in December of 2011. This deposit was made in October.
Okay.
And so when we learned about it, we learned about it from the bank. We notified counsel and the probation officer, and that was, you know, at least a month or two later.
So the district judge actually makes a finding that there's materiality because his finances are relevant to all sorts of things, fine, restitution, costs, related expenses.
Right, and it is material. If we look at what was not presented here to the probation officer, four bank accounts, it raises the question, who is this man, a janitor with eight bank accounts? Who has eight bank accounts? And one of them is co-owned with a Nevada corporation we know nothing about. And what does he report? $1,000 in monthly income, a net worth of less than $10,000, and a very small amount of cash. So all of a sudden, he comes up with $25,000. We don't know the source of that money. This raises the question of what kind of financial means does this person have? Again, a janitor, and the probation officer lists a host of hundreds of thousands of dollars in loans that he supposedly made to other people or purported investments, and he recalled all of those details. He recalls for a bank account. So I would submit that this isn't a case where the defendant submitted stacks of information and just happened to forget this deposit that happened the very same day. For all we know, it may have happened before he provided that statement to the probation officer. We don't know the timing of it. We just know it happened the same day.
So what's your position on any duty on Mr. Manojlovich's part to correct a statement that he quickly learns is inaccurate? Is there such a duty?
There is a duty. If you realize that what you've provided to essentially the court is incomplete information, whether it was intentional or not, and you come to learn I left out a pretty big gap here. I'm reporting a net worth of less than $10,000, and I just happened today to come into possession of $25,000. I should correct it today. And that's money, although counsel may not view it as significant, it's significant in the context of what he's telling the probation officer. And as the court points out, that's a lot of money to most people.
I have a curious question, and maybe it's not very relevant, but basically he sold his own house, whatever he did, and then just was able to collect money from another bank and then paid off his previous mortgage. Isn't that the
sequence?
That's
right, Judge. What this basically was a mortgage fraud scheme. The defendant was in default on his mortgage, so they cooked up basically a fake transaction where he would, you know, sell his property to another person. That person would pay for it by getting a mortgage loan from a commercial mortgage lender. And, of course, that person had no intention of paying back the loan.
But my curiosity is that they paid off the original mortgage.
They did.
Did that bank get to keep that money? I'm just curious. I know that is off subject, but it just seems if the bank got paid off with fraudulently obtained money. I'm just wondering if they
The first bank was paid off, Your Honor. The defendant himself got an extra $129,000.
Right. He did real well on this.
And then it was the second lender that was left holding the bag. They, in turn, sold their mortgages into the secondary mortgage market. And so institutions down the line incurred the actual losses.
All right. Well, I just wonder how these transactions go undetected that well, but I know that's beside the point.
Well, and it's relevant, too, because the defendant owes $259,000 in restitution, and the fact that he's not telling the court about this $25,000 raises the question of, does he really accept responsibility for what happened here? what is this man's character? Is he really interested in repaying restitution if he has access to this kind of money? And again, there's all these other so-called investments out there that we know very little about. And I would just submit the picture he painted for the probation officer and for the court raises more questions than answers. So I would say that this information was very material. The court had enough here. The court made a common sense ruling here. He looked at what he was presented and said basically this was a lie. This wasn't something that just happened by mistake. And it wasn't as if the defendant came forward and disclosed this voluntarily. He was forced to, basically, because this information came out through the government. And so he did the smart thing and he said, oops, you know, I got to correct this error. But it wasn't as if he did that on his own.
So there's just a fact question, the circumstances behind the failure to disclose and his intent, and the district judge makes the call. So I assume we're on clear error review.
We are on clear error, Judge, and as you know, that with that standard, even if you were to disagree with the judge, if you find that there's enough here, and I'd submit there is, that decision must stand. And so for the reasons we state in our brief, we would recommend that the court affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Anything further, Mr. Greenberg?
Yes, please.
I disagree a little bit on the standard. I agree that on the if there's a factual determination, it would be clear error, but otherwise it's de novo. And the information.
How can this not be a question of fact? I mean, you're saying it was inadvertent, he was overwhelmed with all this paperwork, the judge sees it otherwise. That strikes me as a question of fact.
Well, because I think that that when it comes to materiality, that phrase, as I said, is sort of ignored. It's not given enough deference. And when the judge got the information, the judge had all the information. None of the information given to the judge was incorrect. Now, I know the guideline commentary makes reference to statements to making false statements in a pre-sentence investigation report. But the investigation report that went to the judge had all of this information. The judge could have looked at the non-disclosure or the initial information and what happened with the money and considered that at sentencing. But to give him an obstruction enhancement is different.
Well, but honestly, I mean, you know, when things have sorted themselves out by the time they get to the judge is still entitled to take into account obstructive conduct along the way, and that's the call this judge makes.
I think that the judge, if he's going to take it into account the way this scenario went, where when the information got to the judge, he had all the information and everything had been corrected, whatever, they can put their spin and we can put our spin on how it came about the corrections. I think that at that point that it just becomes something you can go into is a 3553 factor. And in fact, the judge commented that this was a fraud case, and he was troubled by the fact that this occurred in a fraud case. And that would go to the other 3553 factors, character, and so forth. But to say that this rises to the level of a sentencing enhancement under the guidelines, I don't think it should rise to that. And
that,
I think that's the distinction.
That argument is a free pass for all obstructive conduct that occurs in the run-up to sentencing, as long as it's discovered by the time of sentencing. And that can't possibly be an appropriate interpretation of the guidelines.
No, I don't think all obstructive conduct that runs up to the time of sentencing.
That's
if
your
the court
argument, that there's this sort of enhanced treatment of the issue if the discovery is made and ultimately corrected by the time of sentencing, then the judge can't consider it unless he finds actual materiality. That's the basis of your argument here.
Well, when it comes to the pre-sentence investigation, I'm saying that should be the case. Not when it comes to, for instance, perjured testimony, for which there seems to be a catch-all false statements, confusion, mistake, and so forth, which he didn't take into account here, whether there was confusion or mistake. But I'm saying when it comes to the pre-sentence investigation, when it gets to the judge, if the information given to the judge is complete, how that information was assembled he can take into account, but it shouldn't rise to the level of obstruction. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. The court will take the case under advisement.